Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to this program. And this is a program that is done in partnership with the Longevity Foundation and Cancer Care. And the topic is non-small cell lung cancer for caregivers, practical tips for coping. And this is part three of living with non-small cell lung cancer. And today's program is supported by Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Regeneron, and a grant from Genentech. We want to thank them for their support of today's program. First, I'd like to tell you how many people are on the call. So we have over 123 participants on the call today who come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Afghanistan, Canada, Lebanon, Pakistan, Romania, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call. And as a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us to focus on really non-small cell lung cancer for caregivers and practical tips for coping. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Robert Hsu, and Dr. Hsu is Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, UCS Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Hsu will be addressing an overview of non-small cell lung cancer, the important role of the caregiver in communicating with the healthcare team, the increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments, the caregiver's role in decision-making for a loved one with non-small cell lung cancer, and challenges in communicating with the healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hsu.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you to Longevity Foundation and Cancer Care for putting together this teleconference today. And living in Southern California, I also want to just share my condolences to anyone that's been affected from the wildfires. I first wanted to talk about kind of overview of non-small cell lung cancer. So, you know, with lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer constitutes the vast majority, about 85% of all lung cancers. And so, you know, the best way, because, there's been a lot of advances in the field of lung cancer, which can understandably make things very difficult to follow. But, you know, I like to best compartmentalize, into categories that can make it easier for you all as patients and caregivers to understand all the complexities. So, within lung cancer, there's small cell lung cancer and there's non-small cell lung cancer that I said, constitutes the vast majority of lung cancer. And then within non-small cell lung cancer, there's different types of non-small cell lung cancer that you can see under the microscope. So there's adenocarcinoma, which is the most common. There's squamous cell carcinoma. And then there's also what could be a mix of adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. And then there's also large cell carcinoma. These tend to be the minority of cases. So that's kind of one aspect. And another aspect is looking at, well, what is the extent of the lung cancer? So the non-small cell lung cancer. So typically, the vast majority of patients, they present with a symptom, whether it's shortness of breath, coughing up blood. They inevitably go to a healthcare facility and then find this initial finding that there's a concern for a mass that could be in the lung, but also can travel to other areas in the body, and then undergo a biopsy, which can be, if it's in the lung, typically it's done with a scope that goes down into the lung and biopsy, but to take a biopsy being a piece of tissue that's taken out from the mass. But if it's gone to other areas outside of the lung, they typically do biopsies outside of there in different methods. So once you get the biopsy result, then the next part is what we call staging. And so the staging kind of tells us whether the lung cancer is still in the primary site where it originated, it's in the lung, whether it's specifically in one spot in the lung, has it traveled to another part of the lung, or has it traveled to other organs in the body, organs being like, has it traveled to the brain, has it traveled to the bones, has it traveled to the liver. And typically what will happen is the patients will undergo scans, whether a PET CT scan, PET scan, a CT scan. And for the brain, typically an MRI is done to evaluate the extent of the lung cancer. And so if the lung cancer is predominantly, so depending on the staging, the lung cancer is localized, then we, the next part of it is kind of figuring out treatment. And so, treatment is typically can be, whether it can be localized treatment. So if it's localized, it can be surgery or radiation, or it can be systemic treatment if it's particularly spread outside of the lung and it's considered metastatic lung cancer, and that can be done with, there's different types of systemic therapy. So there's chemotherapy, which is the standard, what people say, it kills good cells, bad cells. There's immunotherapy, which has kind of come along the last 10, 15 years and kind of engages the body's immune system to help try to fight the cancer cells. And then there's we have targeted therapies, which are, which specifically target specific changes in the tumor, in the DNA changes in the tumor. And so one of the tests that now has become a big factor is not just looking at the microscope and saying that this is adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma. It's actually looking to see if there's actually changes, mutational changes in the DNA, the RNA, to see if there's a specific mutation, because we now have what we call targeted therapies or pills that can go after these treatments, the cancer. And so the staging is a big factor because, it really determines the treatment. It used to be that, the localized treatments would just be predominantly just radiation or just surgery, but now it's become more complex and involves, multimodality. So, you can do surgery, followed by targeted therapy. You could be asked, they could be offering chemotherapy and immunotherapy prior to surgery. And so, actually now it's really important to make sure you have all this information in order to come up with a plan. And typically, it's a multidisciplinary effort when it comes to, managing, the patient's care. And so, those are kind of the important things I think to know when, as kind of patients and caregivers, is to know, what type of lung cancer it is. Is it, non-small cell lung cancer, small cell lung cancer? Within the types of lung cancer, is it adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma? And then the staging, is it confined in that main spot, one spot in the lung, or is it traveled to other areas in the body for staging? Which, typically they'll say stage one, stage two, stage three, which is early stage. And typically those stage one to three is combined in the lung. And stage four is when it's gone outside of the lung. And then to ask, did you find anything in the molecular testing? Were there any key mutations that were noted? And then the last question being, what are the treatment options for me or my loved one? That's really kind of the major, overview of non-small cell lung cancer. The next topic I'll talk about is kind of the important role of the caregiver. So, just summarizing these things that I summarized in the last few minutes, with all the increasing, treatments that we have, it can be quite complicated and really an information overload, for patients. And you can imagine going through, such a difficult diagnosis and trying to be able to come up with, in terms of trying to process all the information. So that's where, caregivers can really play a really helpful role in terms of being able to help process the information. Because many times, I work with patients and, it's understandably, they're dealing with the emotions and a lot of the information is not going to be picked up. And so, caregiver can really help with process, helping process all the information and also really communicate with the members of the healthcare team. So, you know, sometimes, you know, it's not just, you know, the physician or provider, but also, you know, the navigator or the nurse, other members of the healthcare team, in terms of being able to follow up with, you know, maybe in terms of follow up with, you know, some of the logistics for care that, you know, might be really overwhelming for the patient. And then also being able to, you know, ask and follow up in terms of information. You know, sometimes a lot of the information is given the first visit is quite overwhelming. And so, you know, being able to kind of follow up for in terms of education follow up and trying to reiterate points that may have been confusing during that first visit with the oncologist. And so another aspect, you know, that I think is important is kind of the decision making. And so certainly as a caregiver, you know, if the patient is, you know, feeling kind of, you know, not sure about what to do because of a lot of the information or not feeling well, you know, caregiver really has an important role. And I think one of the things that's important, I think, in a caregiver's role early on is to really try to understand, you know, the patient's wishes and, you know, kind of what they're aiming for treatment. I think as providers, we try our best to try to get the sense as to what the patient wants for treatment because, you know, these treatments are not side effect free. And sometimes, you know, many times patients have certain goals as their treatment. And I think it's important as caregivers to understand kind of what the patient, you know, wants in terms of their goals for treatment. And so I think that's an important role for the caregiver. It's also important because down the road, if the patient is not, you know, feeling up to making the decision because they're not feeling really sick or not sure what to do, that's where the caregiver can really help with decision-making. And then, you know, I think one of the things that comes with all this is kind of challenges with communicating with the healthcare team. And so I think one of the biggest things I think is important is just trying to establish that open line of communication with the team. You know, I think at the first visit, we always like to try to develop kind of like, here's a clear communication pattern. You know, what are the numbers to contact if there's any questions, who to contact, because there's going to be a lot of, you know, questions or concerns. And I think the most important thing and the best first step is to be able to know what number can I call, or, you know, where can I send a message, you know, if the patient isn't feeling well or has a question about the medication that they're taking or their treatment that they're getting. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And I think the other challenge is also being able to, you know, and I think one of the other challenges I think that can happen also is, you know, as providers, we see the patients, you know, we see them once every 2 weeks, we can see them once every 3 weeks, but many times we don't get to see them, you know, we don't get to see them every day. And I think that's where a caregiver can really be important in terms of helping with communicating with the healthcare team. Sometimes we don't ask the right questions or miss the question. That could be really telling an important part of the patient's symptoms and how we can best treat their symptoms or their management. And so I think that's one aspect that I think is really important with the caregivers, to be able to ask the question in terms of, you know, in terms of being able to help with, you know, maybe providing additional information that we may not get when we're directly asking the patient, you know, how are they feeling? And I think the one last aspect that I wanted to also mention is kind of the increasing role for telehealth, telemedicine. And so that's something that I think happened, you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the silver linings was kind of being the increasing use for telemedicine. And I think it plays a couple of really important roles. I mean, sometimes, you know, patients who are not feeling well just need to, and, you know, a phone call and an email, or a message on the electronic medical record may not be sufficient to really help explain their symptoms. But as I said, they may not feel kind of up to driving, you know, 45 minutes to go see their oncologist. And so I think telemedicine can be really helpful in that it could be a way to communicate with the patient via video, and be able to kind of triage the situation in terms of, you know, do they need to come into the healthcare facility, or is this something that can be managed at the house? And also, maybe easier for not just one caregiver, but multiple family members or friend or close friends that want to communicate with the, you know, and be involved in the telemedicine and can provide additional input. And the other aspect I think that can be helpful with telemedicine is that certainly with the complexities of non-small cell lung cancer it can be really tough, you know, as general oncologists who especially cover in the community setting to really keep track of all the new findings and also, you know, possible clinical trials. And so, you know, especially in larger states like where I live in California, sometimes we'll have patients from Northern California, example, they may want to get a second opinion from someone who's, you know, who focuses on lung cancer and may want to hear about, you know, if there might be any new findings that, you know, that they may not have heard with from their oncologist at home, or may want to know if there's a clinical trial that's available that, you know, could be a treatment option that they were not aware of. And many times as oncologists, we do work with oncologists in the community, you know, because it is certainly it's a team effort to really work together. So those are kind of the things that I have for today, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions at the end.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hsu. That was just a wonderful presentation, and you're the first speaker, so you've really set the stage for today's program, and you really identified some of the issues that our participants really need to hear about in terms of lung cancer and also in terms of their role as caregivers on the healthcare team. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. So thank you. Very stellar presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. Dr. Palos is a doctor of public health, a master's degree in social work, and an RN. She's former clinical protocol administration manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in caregiving and survivorship and healthcare disparities. And she'll be addressing taking on the role of the caregiver, what research tells us about caregivers, challenges and rewards of caregiving, coping with each day on special occasions and birthdays, managing family and friends, and self-care tips for managing the stress of caregiving. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Palos.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Messner, for the invitation to join this esteemed panel on caring for a loved one diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer. Before I begin, though, I'd like to give a shout out to all our participants, our international and our domestic, for kicking off 2025 by increasing your awareness and knowledge of caregiver tips and challenges for managing this non-small cell lung experience. Dr. Hsu established a solid overview of this disease and the importance of telemedicine and the need to establish effective and open communication between the patient, their caregivers, and their cancer care health team. And I will follow his excellent presentation by focusing briefly on the role of caregiving, managing caregiving during special occasions, and then I'll end by sharing some self-care and stress management tips. I believe currently, and some of you may also, the U.S. is facing a caregiver crisis, and other countries also. Caregivers are and continue to be valuable and essential resources in our healthcare system. Yet, caregivers are often underappreciated, overlooked, and somewhat invisible during patient-provider visits. But we need to remember caregivers need education, coaching, and reassurance to help grow their knowledge, skills, and awareness. Providing care to an individual with a chronic illness such as cancer is generally viewed as a significant life stressor. What's good, though, is that the rewards and challenges of cancer caregiving have been intensely studied over the last four decades. And in a bit, I'll talk a little bit about some new areas of caregiver research that are coming out. Realistically speaking, though, the cancer journey is a dynamic experience, which means the caregiver's role will change over the course of the disease. And caregivers have multiple roles when caring for a loved one. For example, caregivers provide companionship and emotional support, often on a 24/7 schedule. They monitor, assess, and report symptoms to the cancer care team. When needed, they assist with complex tasks such as tube feeding and monitoring medication adherence. And in addition, caregivers must become case managers and navigators. They often are called upon to help coordinate services for mental or multiple health and human agencies to make difficult decisions about service needs. These agencies often have different guidelines or eligibility criteria, making it difficult for a caregiver to determine how to access needed services. And then caregivers must also deal with financial concerns, insurance coverage, legal documents such as advance directives, wills, and power of attorneys. It is a challenge for our caregivers. It's become a challenge that now the research is saying caregiving health is considered a public health concern. So this issue requires more attention from our healthcare professionals, our policymakers, caregivers, and researchers. So I'd like to quickly highlight a few new areas of interest in research. I'd like to talk a little bit about the invisible caregivers. These two groups are comprised of male caregivers and young caregivers between the ages of 8 to early 30s. When we think about caregivers, we usually see an adult being the caregiver, and it's usually a woman based on the research that has come out. But now, especially during the pandemic, we found that these two groups, males and young caregivers, were also becoming responsible as the caregivers. And it continued once the family members that had been in the household to help had to go back to work. So for male and young caregivers, we must change the mindset of our scientific community, our policymakers and healthcare providers, to create programs that meet their specific needs and to give attention to their specific needs with new research. So I just want to toss that out because I think sometimes we don't realize that caregivers come across all age groups, not just adults and not just females. Research indicates that family caregiving has been associated with increased levels of depression, higher use of psychotropic medications, poor self-reported physical health, and compromise in the immune function. Gladly, though, or good, is that caregivers also report that there are rewards of being a caregiver. Examples include experience of personal growth and role satisfaction, developing closer relationships and interactions with others, including their care recipients, and establishing a greater appreciation of life and empathy towards others. Other caregivers report it's increased their own faith and it's helped clarify their life's priorities. Research also indicates that when caregivers neglect their own health care needs, there may be a sense of increased vulnerability. So I'd like to move on to say a bit about the role of a caregiver during special occasions, such as holidays, birthdays, and vacations. Living with cancer during the holidays and these special events creates a unique and at times troubling experience for caregivers, the patient, and of course the family. I'm sure that many of you on this call experienced surprises, challenges, and found solutions during the recent holidays. In the next few moments, I'll cover strategies that may help manage some of the chaos associated with these occasions. One helpful strategy is to develop a special occasion or travel preparedness plan. The plan is like a hurricane preparedness plan. It maps out the details of how to prepare for those special events. The plan can make trade-offs in the caregiver's role when needed, and especially during these special occasions, and especially when they live far away from our caregivers, which one of our speakers will address later. A recent family experience really called my attention to an area that sometimes we tend to forget because we're doing so much hands-on care for our loved ones. It's important, and I can't stress this enough, lesson learned, to have essential legal documents readily available. For example, have the insurance policies on health, long-term disability, and even home and auto insurance. Have the paperwork on power of attorney for healthcare and financial decisions, living will, advance directives, and others. Each of these pieces of papers are important to have. Organize them, or I would suggest trying to organize them into a binder or folder. They can be a hard copy or a digital format, whichever works for you. But being prepared with these type of documents will ensure that your loved ones' plans are honored, to help make sure their finances are protected, and especially help to make critical decisions during these challenging times. And even as a caregiver, will be prepared and empowered to advocate for your loved one as needed. So in a caregiver prepared plan, be realistic about what can and cannot be done. You know, with holidays, be flexible about traditions and customs associated with those family gatherings, and even create new traditions. When travel is difficult, just look at social media. We have Zoom, Skype, FedEx, and FaceTime that can help bring you and your loved ones closer together. If you are going to travel, give your entire healthcare team notice that you'll be traveling. For how long and in what region? Is it domestic? Is it international? Ask them to help you identify critical tasks that must be followed, and if needed, suggest alternative methods for you to deal with some of the tasks. It's important to be vigilant, though, during these times, because we tend to forget about medications and things like that, our own as well as our loved ones. Be sure to be vigilant about the medication of your loved one's needs and yourself. And when flying, I'd like to suggest that you keep your loved one's medication in a small carry-on bag with all the medicines. And you can keep them in the container or the original bottles, but just keep them close. And if you have pets that aren't going to travel with you, let your veterinarian know about your travel and set up a boarding plan for your fur babies. So it seems that caregivers seem to be better prepared for patients' needs, but often forget about their own health needs. So remind yourselves, the roles and responsibilities of the caregiver will change throughout the cancer experience. And it's no surprise that as these roles change, the emotional and physical health of caregivers will also change. And that's why it's important to ask to get caregivers involved in helping with this experience. So never forget, people like to help. And if given a chance, most likely they say yes. And it's okay if they say no. Just cross them off your list and move on to the next person. Just know that this expanded network of circle of caregivers will help you, the caregiver, to lessen your caregiver burden. Also remember to reach out to your community healthcare professionals and organizations, your loved ones who are the patient, and also you will benefit because you are going to be more prepared and healthier and happier. One other thing I'd just like to mention is it's hard to ask for help. Caregivers have shared reasons for not seeking help, including, I don't know who to ask. It's too hard to ask. I don't know if anyone can care for my loved ones like I do. Do not be embarrassed or shy to ask for help. Remind yourself, the caregiver experience is a team effort. No one can go through this experience themselves. So finally, and most important, keep tabs on your physical and mental health. Caregiving can be an isolating experience. It can lead to physical symptoms such as fatigue, interrupted sleep, weight gain, increased colds and infections. It can lead to emotional symptoms such as feeling overwhelmed, losing interest in activities you once enjoyed. It can also lead to anger, frustration, anxiety, or sadness. That's okay. Just know that these symptoms are going to fluctuate depending on the status of your loved ones, and know that you need to take care of them. And know that it's important not to ignore these signs. They are red flags, just like a temperature of 104 degrees or a blood pressure of 180 or 100. If these symptoms are ignored for a long period of time, it can increase the risk of caregiver burden. And sometimes when the combination of stress, burnout, and all these roles, it can lead also to the abuse of alcohol or other substances, which interferes with your own health as well as with your loved one's health. So some evidence-based strategy that has been have been shown to be successful is to sleep well, set boundaries for your family, friends, and yourself. Believe it or not, it's okay to say no. It's okay not to answer the phone immediately, and it's okay not to consistently check your emails. Let yourself listen to your feelings. Crying, grieving, and sadness can help clear your mind and provide relief. Take breaks, trying mindfulness, meditation, yoga, or deep breathing. Now, those little techniques seem like they're kind of weird to some people, but let me tell you, they make a difference, and the research is certainly showing that. Move your body. It matters. If you're in the hospital with your loved ones, go out and walk around the clinic area, the hallways for a bit. And if you can, get out and just walk and look at nature. Even 10 minutes will make a difference. And when needed, do not hesitate to join a support group or seek professional help to manage your stress and overall emotional health. Ms. Fish-Saval and Ms. Molfetes will address these valuable resources in a moment. The cancer caregiver journey is a difficult path to follow. In fact, I don't know if there's a perfect day in a caregiver's journey with their loved one's experience. However, there can be a balance of highs and lows. Work hard to maintain and sustain your own self-care practices. Thank you for allowing me to share these thoughts with you. Dr. Messner, this concludes my remarks, and I'll return the program to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Paulus. That was just an outstanding presentation for all the caregivers on the program today. I hope that you'll take advantage of also not only listening to Dr. Paulus live, but also you'll be able to listen to it as a podcast in about a week as well. It'll be up for at least a year, and you'll be able to listen to a lot of her suggestions and tips, which I think you'll find incredibly helpful. And I think there's one point that she made, you need to have a circle of caregivers, and you really do need to ask people. It's amazing when you ask people, some people will say yes and some will say no, and you'll move on to the next person. And sometimes caregivers come unexpectedly. There's somebody who helps who you didn't expect to help, and somebody who expected to help doesn't help. So anyway, I know you'll have questions for Dr. Paulus, and that was just a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Anne Fish Stegall, and Ms. Stegall is an RN and a BSN, and she's Senior Vice President, Patient Services and Health Care Delivery, Longevity Foundation, and she'll be addressing Longevity Foundation's free programs and services and Lung Cancer Helpline, as well as how to contact both their website and info at Longevity. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague and partner on today's program, Ms. Anne Fish-Stegall.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It is certainly our pleasure at Longevity to partner with cancer care as we have done over the years, and we appreciate the invitation to talk about what Longevity has to offer. Longevity is a global lung cancer foundation, and we live by the mission that we are transforming how people are diagnosed and live with lung cancer through research, education, and support. Longevity Foundation is firmly committed to making an immediate impact on increasing the quality of life and survivorship of all people touched with the diagnosis of lung cancer. We are working to accelerate research in early detection and more effective treatments, provide community support and education for all those affected by the disease. At Longevity, we know that navigating a lung cancer diagnosis can be overwhelming. If you're looking for general information, tips, or guidance, you might want to start with Longevity's patient gateways. Those can be reached at www.longevity.org. Navigating to whether you are a patient, survivor, or caregiver, and then to our gateways pages. They will give you an idea of what to expect from your diagnosis and throughout treatment. We have resources for caregivers as well as those undergoing active treatment and survivors. They serve as a central hub for our information resources, and our latest news on different types of cancer are there. Each patient gateway has educational material specifically tailored to your unique type of cancer. In other words, there is a non-small cell gateway. There are specific gateways for the oncogenes like ALK, EGFR, KRAS, rare mutations and fusions, and also small cell lung cancer. You can join one of our real-time virtual meetups and meet survivors, caregivers, and friends, and people just like you who are going through the same things. You can also find our online support community at any one of our many Facebook groups, or you can connect on our message boards. Recently, we have added a small cell cancer, lung cancer Facebook page called The Smashers, and we would invite those of you who are diagnosed with small cell or caregivers for small cell patients to check out our Smashers page and to also join us for our Facebook Live fireside chats with Dr. Misty Shields of the University of Indiana. We also have peer-to-peer mentoring programs, and we would be happy to connect you with someone with your type of cancer or with another caregiver who can help mentor you and give you some advice. We also have sections to help you find clinical trials, to help you find experts, and also the announcement of any of our survivor events, such as Hope Summit, which is a weekend-long conference for patients, survivors, and caregivers that gives hope to all those that are touched. We also have our International Lung Cancer Survivorship Conference, which is an online conference in the early fall, where we invite speakers from around the world to share their expertise. We are very involved in precision medicine and have an online guide to help direct conversations with your healthcare team on biomarker testing and what the results mean. We are grateful for this opportunity to introduce you to Longevity. We want to be your trusted source of information, resources, and support. And I would invite you to check us out at our website and any of these extracurricular activities like Facebook and our Facebook Lives. Dr. Messner, I'll give it back to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. And it's a wonderful resource for everybody on this call today. And please, if you haven't already taken advantage of Longevity Foundation's many resources, please do do contact them. And we, at the end of today's program, well, actually, it'll be in about a week, you'll be receiving a SurveyMonkey evaluation, which is an evaluation of the program. But in that evaluation, we also put in all of the resources that we mentioned during the program. So any resource, website, anything we've given during the program, you'll be getting in the SurveyMonkey evaluation as well. So it serves dual purposes. It's an evaluation of the program, but it also gives you additional resources. And our next speaker is Ms. Nikki Loafitis, and she's an oncology social worker, New Jersey program coordinator, cancer care. And Ms. Loafitis will be addressing the role of the long-distance caregiver, Cancer Care's free programs and services, and Cancer Care's Hope Line and website. And it's really my great pleasure to have turned this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Loafitis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, and thank you everyone for being here today. As just noted, I'll be sharing a little bit about the role of the long-distance caregiver and some of our Cancer Care's free programs and services. So as mentioned throughout this program, there are many rewards to being a caregiver. However, with long-distance caregiving, sometimes it can feel like a challenge. You may feel guilty for not being physically present with your loved one. You also may not know how to help them since you can't see them every day. You may also feel like your title isn't caregiver, which isn't true. You know, a lot of times we hear the word caregiver and we think we have to be nearby, we have to help with tasks, we have to help with travel, medication management, etc. But being a long distance caregiver, you're still caregiving. And you also might experience burnout. All of these are completely normal. However, there are many ways that you can still help your loved one, even being a long distance caregiver. So what can your role look like? You might want to incorporate family communication. Considering how much information you want to tell family and friends is actually a form of self-care. Talk with your loved one about whom you want to share the diagnosis with and why. You may be able to set up care for them through different organizations, one being My Cancer Circle, Lots of Helping Hands, or even setting up a meal train. You could set up meal trains through different organizations, or you can set it up on your own as well. Also identifying what you need from those others. I know that was talked a lot about today, but recognizing how can they help you? Can they help with groceries? Can they help with chores? Can they help you where you're at? Or can they help your loved one where they are at? So really recognizing that family communication. Along with family communication, your role might be able to assist with care management and care arrangement. If our loved one needs in-home support, you may be able to contact their insurance company to identify a home health aide to assist with a certain amount of hours in the home. If we don't have that option, or if home health aide is not something that's needed, maybe there's a neighbor or a family member that's nearby that can just go and sit with them and be a support who is close by. But you still are the one to set that up, and that's your role as a long-distance caregiver. There's also medical coordination. From a distance without realizing it, we can assist with scheduling appointments if we have that availability. And you can also phone in when your loved one is going to a doctor's appointment. You can see what time it is, if you're able to be on speaker during that appointment. Sometimes your loved one is able to record the appointment. Typically, doctors are okay with this, but we definitely recommend asking ahead of time. But that is still something that you could be part of, even from a distance. And then also just having that emotional and financial support. You might be able to research and set up practical and emotional support for your loved one, seeing what they may qualify for. Maybe that's some financial support through different organizations. Maybe it's researching supports in their area, like a support group that they're able to be part of, or a community group that they can engage in, something to keep them supported while you're not right next to them. And then along with that, being a distance, you can set up check-ins with them yourself, that you now have the opportunity to FaceTime with them. You can text them here and there. Maybe you schedule certain phone calls, you know, every day at 3 o'clock, that's your time to connect with them via phone. If it's a big family group and you want everybody to connect, maybe you start a Zoom and you're able to join that way as well. There are so many platforms now that are available to us to allow us to connect with our loved ones from a distance. I just want to reiterate that there is no right or wrong way to be a caregiver. Any effort that you are putting in is more than enough. Being patient with yourself is important. Being kind to yourself is important. And reminding yourself that you're always doing more than enough. Kind of like mentioned earlier, reminder to take some time to check in with yourself. Ask yourself on a scale of 0 to 5, 0 being the worst, 5 being the best, how am I feeling today? Because in caregiving, we are caregiving for our loved one, and they are super important in this situation, but you're also important as well. And then lastly, I do want to talk a little bit about our cancer care organization and the many resources that we have to offer. While we are based in New York and New Jersey, we do offer services nationally. So we have limited forms of financial assistance and co-payment assistance. We offer online support groups, which is a message board format where you're able to connect with other individuals who might be in a similar situation. We also have some community-based programs and educational workshops, just like this platform that you're all part of today. And then we also offer resource navigation, commonly known as case management, where an individual can assist with identifying various resources within your area. If you go to cancercare.org, there you'll find other cancer-based organizations that we partner with as well. For individuals who do reside in New York and New Jersey, we do also offer individual counseling and live support groups. As mentioned earlier, we do have a hope line where you can connect with an oncology social worker. Through the website that was provided, cancercare.org, you'll find our hope line in order to navigate these services and see what might be the best fit if interested. Thank you all so much for having me today. That concludes my presentation, and I will turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Malfitis. That was a wonderful presentation, lots of resources for people, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. We're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Rob to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And so this is a question for Dr. Hsu. My spouse, who is the patient, is often in a frustrated and bad mood during her chemotherapy cycles due to various side effects. While I understand her frustrations is not directed towards me, I sometimes find it difficult to stay fully empathetic and supportive when I am around someone who is in a bad mood all the time, leading me to also be frustrated. Any advice? Dr. Hsu, could you comment on that?
Yeah, thanks for the question. And certainly, with the way the chemotherapy and the cycles of the ups and downs in terms of the side effects, certainly challenge in terms of how patients feel. I mean, I think, there's a couple of things that, in terms of advice, one, first, hearing out, I think it's important. Well, many times, the patient just wants to be listened. I think they know that it might be difficult for your caregiver to do anything in terms of they're not going to change their chemotherapy, but I think listening and maybe hearing out their venting is probably one thing that I think helps. I think another aspect is maybe like during the ask, maybe if there's something that in particular is bothering them, there might be a side effect that that could be addressed, whether it's with treatment or whether it's with that could be addressed at a future appointment. I think that's something that is important because maybe they're in a bad mood because they're feeling nauseated, and there could be medications for nausea. And I also think that there also could be other things that they could identify that could help with allowing us to maybe refer and involve other people in the team. Maybe if there are some stressors, emotional stressors, psychological stressors, to help, in terms of whether it's getting, social work involved in terms of helping out with like mental health resources. And I also think sometimes, the last thing I want to say is I think maybe trying to have, maybe if there's other people in the family or other friends, I think one of the tough things is when you're the caregiver and you're always around. Sometimes maybe having somebody else there, for just a few hours. And what it could do is, one, give the caregiver kind of a break, mentally and physically. And also, two, maybe a fresh face that's there with the patient could help with, maybe the patient's kind of, improving their spirits.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I have a question for Dr. Palos. Do you have any tips for when you feel like your relationship outside of the caregiver scope is dwindling? My partner started treatment, and it has been rough for the both of us. I still want to have a relationship outside of being her caregiver, but it has been hard to focus on anything else. Many thoughts, Dr. Palos?
Wow, that's a great question. Very, very interesting. One of the things that I've noticed with our cancer patients and the caregivers' relationships is that they often struggle to just keep it in what they would consider a normal way of interacting with each other or supporting and loving each other. So it takes special effort. I had one lady tell me that her and her husband had sat down and decided to do a date night. And on that date night, no one could bother them. And date night could be staying at home and eating, peanut butter and jelly, as she told me once that they had, and pizza. And another time, if he felt well enough, they would go out to dinner. But that was a time that they knew. They picked a specific day and a time. And they knew that that was going to be the time that they were going to be there for each other in the way they thought they used to be. And so they felt like it really helped them. And I have found other couples say it's extra work. It is extra work. And you're exhausted with the caregiving that you're having to do. And if you're working, that's even double whammy on you. So it is something you have to really work on. So perhaps you can sit down with your loved one and just ask, you're really important to me. And our love for each other is very important to me. So what is it that you think we can do to, you know, keep our love going and perhaps even strengthen it while we're going through this? And you can even suggest, how about a date night, you know? And y'all can chuckle over that and see, oh, yeah, I remember when we used to do that. But that would be one way. And then the second thing I would do is really look at other resources. You know, you can talk to other folks. You can talk to therapists. You can use support groups. You know, talk to other patients because they, I'm sure, have gone through very similar situations and have come up with some very unique and interesting ways to deal with these type of situations. It's hard, and I recognize that. So just keep on trying. Add one more challenge to your challenges of caregiving duties, but make this a priority for you and your spouse. I hope that helps.
Oh, thank you so much. So this is a question for Anne Fishtigo. How do you help your loved one to continue to go to MD appointments when they start to refuse? Could you comment on that?
Sure. I think that, you know, one of the things that it's important for caregivers to understand is that all patients feel a loss of control. I think that's one of the things, and I'm sure that Dr. Sue sees this all the time, is that so much about the diagnosis of cancer takes away a human being's control. And sometimes refusing to go to an appointment or refusing a treatment even is their only way to maintain control. So I think that sometimes we have to reschedule an appointment, or we have to say, okay, if you're not going to do this treatment today, let's negotiate when you are going to do it. But, you know, teaching people that it's really important to stay on a protocol or stay on a schedule is important, but we have to also realize that the diagnosis of cancer, the treatment of cancer, and all that goes with it strips human beings of so much control that any place that we can give people a little bit of control is important. And then I find that in my experience as an oncology nurse, that sometimes if you just give a little bit, soon enough, they're right back on schedule and they're right back on track, but they just needed a day to have some control.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Ms. Malafitis, how do you connect with a support group, a caregiver support group?
Great question. If it's specific to cancer care, I can share with you that if you are national, not residing in New York or New Jersey, you can go on our website, which is cancercare.org, and you can register for our online support group. You can also call our Hope Line, and they can help navigate that as well. But if you're looking for any type of support group, a lot of individuals will just Google like support groups near me. You can also connect with the hospital social worker or nurse navigator or patient advocate that is part of your loved one's medical team. And they also might be able to guide you with additional resources that are within that area. And then I know also Facebook has also become a big platform of just different supports for caregivers and loved ones. So that's another area that might provide that support as well. But you can always contact different organizations. I know sometimes researching and going on Google, we feel could be a lot of work sometimes because it doesn't always give us the answer right away. So feel free to contact those organizations that are willing to help, whether it is cancer care, longevity. There are plenty of organizations that are specific to a diagnosis that you could contact, and they might be able to assist that way as well via phone.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Hsu. Could you comment on palliative care and when to ask for a specialist?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, yeah, there's a stigma in terms of palliative care that people get into sometimes, and that, you know, it's they're just focused on like end of life care and hospice. But I actually think that, and studies, research has actually shown that implementing palliative care early on in patients' cancer treatment is beneficial and can lead to kind of improvement in outcomes. And so I actually encourage, patients, if they're noticing whether it's symptom issues and that cannot seem to be controlled, like pain or nausea, or if there's just, they feel like their loved one needs another person to talk to and maybe have time to, spend more time to discuss about things, maybe from more of a, emotional standpoint, that, I think many times, we try our best as oncologists to, obviously to be empathetic, but, with all the information and all the treatments that we're giving, that can be difficult for us to portray to the patients and their loved one. And so, I know we're at the institution I'm at, we get our palliative care team involved pretty early on in patients' treatment. And if they're having any symptom that they seem to have struggle with controlling, or if they're feeling like they need someone additional to talk to maybe talk more about trying to grasp the their disease from an emotional mental standpoint, we get our palliative care involved. So I encourage kind of early kind of intervention palliative care.
Excellent. That's a very excellent recommendation. And I hope everyone is listening and really considers that. And then I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway for today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Hsu. If you just provide a takeaway for today's program, that would be great.
Thank you. So certainly I think the biggest takeaway that I got in hearing from, the other speakers is really, the caregivers have such a wide-ranging role, in terms of the many responsibilities and things that they do. But, really to try to take care of yourself, hearing all the things that you all do as caregivers, it can certainly be overwhelming and can easily lead to burnout. So, definitely try to, find outlets that can help in terms of being able to, make sure that, you are feeling, as a caregiver, you're feeling supported. Don't be afraid to ask or let known about if you're feeling, tired or exhausted. Because I think the last thing we want to see is caregiver being burned out. And, ultimately that doesn't help anyone. And so I think that's the biggest takeaway from my end is that, as caregivers, I know there's a huge responsibility and huge many hats that you wear, and so just to make sure to take care of yourself.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Palos.
Yes, thank you. I would like to, sometimes this journey is, I know it's difficult, and sometimes we forget that sometimes we need to maybe look at some of the laughter, the humor that's there. So I'm going to end it with this. I'd like each of you on this call to visualize yourself in a cape, whatever color you want to have it. It has the initials CW on it. And the CW comes from a statement that I saw online. It says, caregivers are warriors, fearless, courageous, and passionate about protecting those they care for. So when you see that CW cape, remember you are a caregiver warrior. And I'd also like to remind you that you should also be a warrior for your own health. It's a hard journey. It's difficult, but there's a lot of rewards. We talked about those. And it's a day by day and sometimes hour by hour journey. So that visualization may sound silly, but you'd be surprised how it makes you feel a little bit better. And thank you again.
Oh, thank you. That's great. Your takeaway?
I think my takeaway would be sort of twofold. One is that caregivers come in all shapes and sizes, and many definitions of what caregivers look like and what they do and what their scope is, and that we need to remember that it really does take a team. And then each of those people that plays a role in the caregiving world needs to just give themselves a break every now and then. Stop and breathe and realize that there are others who can help you and that you're not in this alone.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Balsitis?
Sure. Yeah. A couple of things I also took away as well. I think even though our loved one is the one who is, you know, getting the treatment at the time, as caregivers, connecting with the medical team and understanding the treatment and the diagnosis is a big part of your role as a caregiver and being an advocate for yourself. And then along with that, kind of similar to what everybody said, that you're important too as a caregiver and your health is important, your well-being is important, and we can't take care of others if we can't take care of ourselves. So just being okay with asking for help, saying no, and it's also okay if people aren't able to help. That was a big takeaway I took away today. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been really phenomenal. And I want to also thank our participants for asking such great questions and for being so well-informed, actually, in your questions. Now, we could not get to everyone's questions, so I want to comment on that. For those of you who were in queue and were able to ask a question, I still recommend that you take your question and go back to your treating healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best. They have your your records in front of them, so that's important. And as a caregiver, ask the healthcare team your question again, and ask it again and again until you get, you know, the answers that you need. Remember, you've learned a lot today, so take what you've learned and bring it to the healthcare team. That's really important. Also, I would like to remind everyone that. It's very important for you to know how to reach your healthcare team, evenings, weekends, and holidays. Now, we've just gone through a large holiday period, but I think that it's really important to always know how to reach your physician's office. Usually during the day, someone picks up the phone, you can reach somebody. But evenings, weekends, and holidays are a problem and are a challenge. So please be sure that you have those numbers to call. As a caregiver, you need the support of your healthcare team, and you need to reach them any time of the day. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.